Windows down, music up. Get ready to hit the road in a new Chevy SUV or truck. Chevy is a name you know and trust. It's Chevy as American as apple pie and baseball. Check out the full line of Chevy vehicles at your local Chevy dealer. Chevy, drive Chicago.
All righty, Wendy Snyder here. It's a Sunday morning, and This Week in Health is sponsored by Northwestern Medicine. And joining us once again, Dr. Santina Wheat, Program Director, McGaw Northwestern Family Medicine Residency at Delnor Hospital. Good morning, Dr. Wheat.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing great. It's a little gloomy looking out there, but we're supposed to see the sunshine later. Fingers crossed.
Yes. Right.
We were talking about ChatGPT just a little while ago and how people are using AI. And I was reading an article about AI being used to answer medical questions. What do you know about that, and is it accurate?
You know, the problem with ChatGPT is it has access to a lot of information that's out there. But it's not always accurate information. And so sometimes the ChatGPT hallucinates, and sometimes it has access to outdated information. So it's very possible that you'll find great information that can help you, but I would want to make sure that you are able to verify that with your regular healthcare professional and not assume that it's always correct 100% of the time.
But something, you know, obviously you can't ask artificial intelligence, you know, here are my symptoms, what do I have? But you can say something like, I just was diagnosed with diabetes. What exactly is diabetes? That's where it could be helpful, right?
That absolutely could be helpful. I just think it's really important that if you do that, usually it'll give you a source of where that's coming from. And I would go back and just make sure that that source is actually real. But it can be really helpful to help you understand, especially if you got a diagnosis and it was overwhelming in your doctor's appointment and you need a little bit more information.
Yeah, it's always so helpful to have someone go with you to a doctor, because if they are giving you some kind of information that is not always great news, it's sometimes like your mind is not, you're not listening really. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. It's sort of like you stop, like you hear the one thing and you don't hear everything that's there. So if you have a family member or a loved one that can go with you and hear some of the other things, or even maybe take notes, that can be really helpful.
Have you ever had it where you're delivering news to a patient or whatever and they ask if they can record it? Because I just feel like if you have to go by yourself, it might not be a bad idea, but I don't know if doctors would approve of that.
You know, usually the places that I have worked in have recommended it not being recorded, though we do our best to include the information in the chart so you can go back. But I have often had people with loved ones on the phone with them that are listening on speakerphone so that everybody can hear the same information at once. So they don't have to be in the room, but they can be listening to what it is.
All right. That's absolutely great advice. So one third of adults in the U.S. have used a chatbot to learn about their health. I'm surprised it's not higher, if you want me to be honest here.
Well, not only that, I think that there's some healthcare organizations that are building chat boxes into the ways where you contact them. So you may have used it more than you even think. But we'll see. We'll see what happens with this.
All right. Well, just, you know, for one of my birthdays, my sister and I are both hypochondriacs. And for Christmas one year, she got me a book that she had purchased for herself. It was like the size of two phone books. And it was the like Mayo Clinic Medical Encyclopedia. So before there was Google, there were the Snyder girls, and people would call us and go, okay, here are my symptoms. What do you think I have? So I was pre-Google with that.
There you go. There you go.
All right. And speaking of which, I'm pretty sure I had norovirus, which I honestly doubt. But I don't know what had happened to me, but I like threw up out of the blue. I didn't know. And I thought it was food poisoning. I don't know. But it moved quickly. And I didn't have a fever. But what is norovirus? And with summer travel, I heard it's is it contagious? Pretty contagious?
You know, I am happy to hear that whatever you had moved quickly.
Yes.
Norovirus is quite contagious. It is a virus that you often can get from being around somebody that's infected or touching similar food. And it can cause vomiting and diarrhea. It usually takes a little bit to come on, but it doesn't last very long. It usually lasts for a couple of days. But it really is contagious. And so if somebody around you has it, then you do have to be careful, making sure you're washing your hands really well, making sure that anybody that's preparing food is really being mindful about that. And then not norovirus, but the food poisoning. This is that time where we have lots of gatherings. And so we might see more of it, making sure that that food is put away, put in the refrigerator, not sitting outside all day without warm temperatures.
I don't know how we didn't get sick when we were younger. We never refrigerated. Like, my brother would order a pizza and didn't want to share with us, so he'd hide it under his bed and then eat it in the morning. So, I don't know. Like, now I would never do that. It has to go in the refrigerator. And I know you're a doctor, so you don't feel funny saying the word diarrhea, but why is everybody else so ashamed to say that word?
I think that we just don't like talking about our bodily functions.
I guess.
I chuckle about the books for the little kids that talk about it to try to normalize it. And I don't know that I had that when I was little. So I do think it's harder sometimes for people to talk about it.
This little girl, I was in a shop and she was with her grandma and she said, "Grandma, I gotta get to a bathroom. I have diarrhea." And it was just so natural. She was probably about 6 or 7 years old. And I like, you know what? I like that. We should all just be honest and open.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that's kind of like the whole mental health thing. It's like people never wanted to talk about it. We need to talk about stuff. We really do. Maybe not on the radio. Maybe I should zip it a little bit. But all right. Well, that's why you're here, to help us with all this information. We're going to take a quick break and continue talking with Dr. Santina Wheat. She's the program director at McGaw Northwestern Family Medicine Residency at Del Nor Hospital. It's 720 WGN. Good morning to you. This Week in Health, we're talking to Dr. Santina Wheat, and she is with Northwestern Hospital, McGaw Northwestern Family Medicine Residency at Del Nor Hospital. She's the program director. Dr. Wheat, I have a friend who has this ear infection, and now she has it in her other ear, and I had never heard about this before. It is a fungal ear infection, and her doctor said that wearing earbuds, or sometimes people wear earplugs at night if they sleep with somebody who snores or something, or they just need quiet, and that contributed to this. Here's another thing I have to be worried about now.
Yeah, so it is quite common for people to use their earbuds all of the time and not really think about cleaning them. You just pop them back in the case and then forget about it. But if you think about that area sort of being a little bit moist, if you get sweaty, especially if you work out with them, then it's an area that fungus can really grow. And so that is why we can see that. So really thinking about making sure you clean them. If you're using earplugs at night while you're sleeping, cleaning those or changing them out. If you have the disposable pipes, because that really fungus can grow anywhere on your body, and this is just contributing to it.
Everybody I see walking around downtown Chicago has earbuds in. I mean, honestly, and here's the thing. She has been taking an antibiotic, and she goes to see the doctor every couple of weeks for the doctor to flush out her ear. But it's taking forever to heal, and he assures her it's on the mend. It's just kind of a long process to get rid of.
It absolutely is, because it's an area that it's just an area where they continue to sit in there, and so it's harder for it to flush out and clean out. So it's just one more thing to be thinking about, making sure that you're staying healthy by cleaning everything around you. And so hopefully that helps prevent it. It's better to not get it in the first place.
Exactly. And the first time she got it, a lot of people don't go to the doctor. Me, if anything's wrong, I go to the doctor because I'm a hypochondriac. I'm sorry, but I'd rather be safe than sorry. My friend did not go right away, and her eardrum was actually perforated from this ear infection.
Oh, wow. Usually we see that from an ear infection that's on the inside. So it's also possible that there was more than one infection going on at the same time. But and our ears are so important. They impact our balance, obviously our hearing as well. And so it's something we want to take care of.
And do they still do those Eustachian tube surgeries? I know like kids who had a lot of ear infections when they were younger, they got that done. Is that still common?
It sure is. It's really important because when kids have the block up in the Eustachian tubes, then it really impacts their ability to hear and then talk. My own daughter actually had it when she was little, and it was sort of night and day difference about how many infections she was having. And honestly, how quickly she started picking up words after that was amazing. So it's something that's small and can be really helpful when it's indicated.
All right. Well, good to know about that. I have to ask you about pelvic floor exercises. We're going to get personal for just a second. Having babies, sometimes women have some issues later in life. So their doctors are always like, do your Kegel exercises. I'm doing them right now, by the way. No, I'm not. Anyway, pelvic floor exercises, I thought it was just for women, but now I find out it's not?
It's not. Pelvic floor exercises are helpful for men as well. Sometimes it's for the same things. Sometimes we talk about the Kegel exercises when somebody is having a hard time holding their urine when they're incontinent. So the same can be true for men. There's also some indication that it can help with problems with erectile dysfunction, and so it really can be helpful. And I find that when people try it and they're not noticing a difference, I'll actually send them to a specialist, a pelvic floor physical therapist, to make sure that they're doing them properly and that they're the right exercises for that person. Because it's not just the Kegels. There's a whole bunch of other sets of exercises that people can do for their pelvic floor and have a world of difference, not just for what we mentioned, but also just pelvic pain in general.
You know how many people are going to be searching ChatGPT for pelvic floor exercises today? Because I know I'm going to.
Topic of the day.
Well, you know, you don't think of it. I'll stupidly admit this. I didn't know only men had prostates. I thought we all had them. Mm-hmm. But now, is that something that a pelvic floor exercise could help with, is a man's prostate?
You know, so when the prostate is large, sometimes that's when we see men having problems with urination. And so, yes, it can be helpful sometimes in that case, especially in combination with the other treatments that they might get with, like, medicines or surgeries.
See, there is so much we learn on this program, and it's all from you, Dr. Wheat. We appreciate it. I have one more question for you. It's kind of a weird one, but I came across this. Incense can actually be dangerous for you. What do we need to know about that?
Absolutely. So when you are when you're burning incense, most people are burning it inside, and so that contributes to the pollution inside, and so therefore how well you're breathing. So sometimes the smell makes people sensitive. Maybe they have allergies, but it also can trigger someone's asthma and make it more difficult for them to breathe. They might start wheezing. But the thing about incense is it's releasing particles also, which people can inhale. And so it's kind of similar to like secondhand smoke, where if you're inhaling those things into your lung, it can be damaging over time. So I know that incense is important for many people for their cultural and religious beliefs, which is wonderful. It's just really important to make sure that you have ventilation if you're using it, so that you can still breathe well and not be super close to the particles and breathing them in.
I guess common sense would tell you, you know, if you're burning something, you're inhaling some kind of smoke and particles, but no one thinks about that. So I thought that was interesting. And someone has texted 708, ask about adults getting that Eustachian tube surgery. Is that something that an adult should consider if they're having chronic ear infections?
I do actually have a few adults that have had the surgery if they have chronic ear infections. We usually talk about it with children because their ears are smaller and so they're more prone to it. But absolutely, if an adult is having chronic infections on the inside, the inner ear and not on the outside, then they do sometimes still need it. And so I've seen some adults really benefit from it.
Well, excellent. Thank you for all your knowledge. We really appreciate you spending Sunday mornings with us, Dr. Wheat. Always a pleasure.
It is my pleasure. Have a great week.
You as well. Dr. Santina Wheat, she is Program Director, McGaw Northwestern Family Medicine Residency at Del Nor Hospital.